You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 143 by Rudolf Steiner, 14 lectures, entitled Three Paths to Christ, Experiencing the Supersensible. These are translated by Christiana Bryan. This is Lecture 8, a second lecture given in Stockholm on the 17th of April, 1912, entitled Three Soul Paths to Christ, Second Part, The Path of Initiation. If in a few words attention might be directed toward the high point of what was presented in yesterday's lecture, I would like to say that as a result of that point, the opportunity ought to be available to every individual by deepening their being correspondingly and through a trusting belief in spiritual worlds, for a mood of soul, an attitude of soul to arise in them whose message is, not only do those things of the surrounding world, stemming as they do from earth evolution itself, flow into the human soul, but it is possible for human beings to condition their souls such that they receive into themselves beneficial forces flowing from spiritual worlds, which can bring about a compensatory balance, one which has flowed into earth evolution, between the individual's egotistical I, capital, and the totality of their constitution, if it is open to this prospect. Whoever can muster confidence in this influx from the spiritual world will have an inner experience, by whatever name they call it, that is a personal, inward Christ experience. Everything else on this subject will emerge once we proceed with the third path to Christ, the path of initiation. In introducing the path via the Gospels and the path of inner experience, we have set out both routes toward Christ that are available to every single person. Certain preparations are involved in the path of initiation, as anyone will understand. If we want to understand what the path of initiation is, and nowadays this includes real, not just theoretical, immersion in the truths of genuine spiritual science, then this at least must be the starting point in modern times. Now it would be good to say a few words in advance about the essence of initiation. Initiation is the highest to which a human being can attain over the course of Earth evolution, because it leads them to a certain comprehension of and insight into the secret mysteries of the spiritual world. What proceeds in spiritual worlds is the content and the object of initiation. Genuine knowing and direct perception of processes in spiritual worlds are achieved on the path to initiation. Even in describing initiation in this way, anyone allowing this characterization to take effect in their soul ought to notice something quite particular. Basically, it has been said that initiation is, if you will allow the expression, a supra-religious path. All the great religions, which have spread across the face of the earth throughout human epochs, and still exist amongst humanity, have, if we study their origins, all been founded upon initiation and endowed by initiates. They flowed from all that the great initiates were able to confer upon humanity. Religions were founded for humanity in such a way that their content related appropriately to their epoch, ethnicity, and even the region in which populations were living. In terms of human evolution, we are now living in quite an exceptional era, and it is precisely the task of spiritual science to understand how this is the case. The way in which spiritual science is being brought to our contemporaries and is capable of being spread abroad has never before been possible in bygone epochs. Anthroposophy as such could never have been communicated in public. It is only now in these times that anthroposophy can be openly imparted. Religions were the way in which the secrets of initiation could flow into humanity in a form suited to a given group of people. But nowadays we are in a position, through anthroposophy, to share something that is not tailored to a single people, nor region, nor to any specific group, but which can bring something of the mysteries of existence to any human being, wherever they find themselves on earth. Souls yearn for this knowledge, which they must receive if hearts are to be strong in their work on earth. This already shows that in anthroposophy something is being conveyed that ought to occupy higher ground than the point at which religious views stood, still stand, and from which they are currently declared. In a certain sense, it is anthroposophy that is tasked with spreading the mysteries of initiation in a pan-human way. Whereas in the various ancient religions across Earth, this was always in a distinct manner that was differentiated according to individual groups of people. Only in these groups could the secrets of initiation be spoken of. What are the consequences of this? It follows that we find the most varied religions spread across the globe, all leading back to their respective religious founder. First, we find a religion of Krishna, leading back to Krishna himself. Secondly, a Buddhist religion, originating with Buddha. And thirdly, the ancient Hebrew religion, originating with Moses. Then, too, Christianity, leading back to Jesus of Nazareth. Because religions flowed from initiation, we need to be quite clear that today we cannot occupy the same ground as that occupied by religious philosophers wishing to appear enlightened. Comparative theologians have a secret view of religions, considering them all false or simply childlike phases of human evolution. We can take a stand as anthroposophists, because we learn to recognize that religions are just differentiated manifestations of initiation wisdom, on the grounds of recognizing the truth, not the falsehood, within all the varied religions. We allow religious systems their full right to exist alongside each other, and see them as equally eligible manifestations of the great truths of initiation. An extraordinarily important consequence follows from this for our practical feeling and practical activity. What is so important? That out of an anthroposophical attitude, a full understanding, an inner respect, and a complete recognition of the core of truth in all religions will follow. And that those who ponder the world in its evolutionary phases, on the basis of anthroposophy, will respect the verities existing in each and every religious system. The greatest reverence will result, and the highest respect will claim its place. Yes, my dear friends, this will be the result to flow from the spiritual stream of anthroposophy for all the religious faiths on earth. You will go to the believers of the different religions of the world, and you will not believe you can graft onto them nor instill in them other beliefs. We will, moreover, go toward them, and, on the basis of our own religious convictions, we will cultivate the truth we find in their beliefs. And if you are born into a region where a particular religion predominates, you will not denigrate nor reject other religions intolerantly, but will be able to go into what can be found by way of truth in its content. Let us take an example. An example such as this can only be understood by those who are in their souls deeply serious about an anthroposophical attitude and about the consequences of knowledge about the nature and basic conditions of initiation. Take a Western individual who grew up within Christianity. They may have come to know Christianity by absorbing the mighty truths of the Gospels. Maybe they have reached what we call the path to Christ through inner experience. Maybe they have already experienced Christ inwardly. Imagine that they come to know another religion, for instance, Buddhism. They learn from those living within the sacred truths and knowledge of Buddhism about what Westerners consider a nuisance, but which we as anthroposophists can understand. Namely, that the founder of their religion, having undergone many incarnations on earth as a bodhisattva, was reborn as the son of a king, the son of Suddhodana. Further, they learn that in the 29th year of his life as a bodhisattva, he attained to Buddhahood, which in this religion stems from initiation, the one great truth, which applies not only to Buddhism but to all humankind, which every initiate will recognize, as will all human beings who understand Buddhism. They learn to acknowledge what believers of Buddhism rightly state. If the bodhisattva can, in one human incarnation, become Buddha, then this incarnation, undergone by Buddha on earth, must be his last. Then he will never again return to a human body. Those within Buddhism would be deeply pained were anyone to claim that Buddha would return to a corporeal body. Deep sorrow would be felt by a follower of Buddhism were some power to question the axiom that the bodhisattva, having risen to Buddha, could never again return to corporeality and appear on earth. As anthroposophists, we try to recognize the truth at the core of every religion, standing on terrain that seeks the truth rather than the errors among diverse religions. So we go to those who understand Buddhism and learn to recognize, or learn from initiation to recognize, that it is true. The individual who lived on earth as bodhisattva has, since that time, reached spiritual heights, from which he need not descend again to the physical rounds of earthly incarnations. From this moment onward, if we were standing on foundations of reincarnation teachings, we will no longer hold up to a Buddhist the claim that Buddha could return to a physical body. Genuine true knowledge will create an understanding for any religious form originating in initiation. We respect all forms of religion that have evolved across the earth by acknowledging the truths they have to offer. Yes, I confess it sincerely and honestly, just as the strictest Buddhist would be able to believe in this verity, that the bodhisattva who lived on earth and rose to become Buddha attained the pinnacle of human development, which made it possible for him no longer to need to descend to earth. That is what it means to have an understanding for the most varied of religious forms here on earth. Let's take the reverse case, that a follower of Buddha were to bring themselves to acquire an anthroposophical awareness. They would focus either on the basis of a real knowledge of Christianity or knowledge of initiation principles, on the fact that for different regions of the world there are different forms of religion, where those who understand religious forms are in agreement that there once lived an individual who actually belonged to no single nation, least of all to the Occident, and that between their 30th and 33rd year this personality was inhabited by such an impetus, a force of spiritual life, to which we referred yesterday, to whom the seven holy rishis referred as their Vishvakarman, to whom Zarathustra referred as Ahura Mazda, to whom the Egyptians referred as their Osiris, and whom the fourth post-Atlantean calls Christ. But this is not the crux of the matter, which is to recognize in Christ what lived as a force for 3 years in the personality of Jesus of Nazareth. An entity which had never before lived on earth had descended from spiritual heights into the personality of Jesus of Nazareth, underwent the mystery of Golgotha in this personality, and as such, this Christ impulse is a unique spur for earth that does not have anything in common with a normal human incarnation. Thus, the being who was on earth as Christ once only, and cannot return in human form, but, as the Bible relates, will come in the clouds of heaven. In other words, who will reappear as a spiritual revelation to humankind, that is a Christian belief. This person living within Buddhism, who is permeated with the gravity and dignity of spiritual science, will have to confess that they need to respect and show some reverence for this Christian faith, too, just as a Christian will need to respect their Buddhist faith. The Buddhist who has ascended to spiritual science and who takes it seriously will say, just as you, being a Christian, bring trust toward the doctrine that the Bodhisattva who became Buddha cannot return to earth, and appropriately, as it strikes me, you know that Buddha cannot return, so I, as a Buddhist, recognize that the being whom you call Christ cannot return to physical incarnation, but lived as a unique force for just 3 years in a physical body. If we can find in anthroposophy such mutual understanding between religions, so that the source of initiation can enter into human hearts, such that no one person could impose an alien concept on another, then we arrive at a concept that unites peoples across the earth. Then we are conferring peace among individual religious beliefs. Jesus of Nazareth lived as the founder of Christianity. Christian initiation tenets apply to the founder of a religion, to Jesus of Nazareth, only as to a fact that can be investigated by occultists as a verity, as a deed. The life of Jesus of Nazareth can be researched with the same love, with the same care, as would be the life of Buddha, or one of the other founders of religions, by those who know the ethos of initiation. A description of the life of Jesus of Nazareth appears, purely on the basis of occultism or spiritual science, in my booklet titled, The Spiritual Guidance of the Individual and Humanity. However, the actual principle of Christian initiation is concerned with recognizing Christ and deals with the path to Christ. This Christian religious determinant has for many centuries been preparing for what we refer to as the concept of freedom across the world, inasmuch as it does not in the least radiate from the founder of a religion as such, but rather from a factual deed which once took place on earth. That is the fundamental difference between Christianity and other religions, the path of initiation leading to Christ as a task within its worldwide mission. That differs from cultures emanating from other religions, in that it emanates from a deed, from an event, and not from a personality. To understand this, we will first have to deal with a few preconditions. A single sentence, a single indication, a single point of origin, albeit externally characterized, describes Christian initiation. It is death that is experienced in the union of Christ with Jesus of Nazareth. The fact of this death, which we know as the mystery of Golgotha, is the sole basis on which we are to understand Christian initiation. One can only gain a real understanding of this death if one is clear about the mission of that death within earth evolution. Yesterday we mentioned that fragility, failing health, disease, and death are connected with the disjunct between our luciferically permeated I, capital, and our dispositions. Ultimately, this luciferic aspect is connected with death, but in a most particular way. It would be completely wrong to assume that Lucifer was the bringer of death. Lucifer did not cause death. He brought what we can call the risk of error, including moral error, the differentiation of humanity into ethnicities, as also the chance of freedom. That is due to Lucifer. If what Lucifer brought were the only principle active among humanity and had nothing opposed him, this luciferic activity would have resulted in humanity falling away, breaking away from divine onward evolution. Humankind would have spiritualized itself, however, in a completely different direction from divine onward progress. To maintain humanity within its divinely ordained onward course and not to allow it to become lost to divine direction, a particular situation had to be brought about, that human beings would, thenceforth, forevermore, be warned of the consequences were they to misuse the potential for error and for freedom. all illness, frailty, sickness, and death, are warnings that human beings would be distancing themselves from divine progressive evolution, even if they were healthy and strong, by relating to the Luciferic option of freedom. Thus, illness, sickliness, and death are not the gifts of Lucifer, but gifts from benevolent, wisdom-filled divine powers, who in giving these have set up ramparts against the influences of Lucifer. Thus we must say, everything continually approaching us in the world by way of external evils, be they illnesses or death, all exist so that we humans remain chained to the earth for as long as is needed for us to take the opportunity of making good, and so that we are taught the better to adapt to our constitutions. We suffer so that through our suffering we create experiences that rebalance our luciferically permeated I and our divinely permeated constitution. Our disposition fails us as often as is required for our I to be fully suffused with the laws of divine progress. Every death is therefore the point of departure for something else. Nobody can die without taking with them the potential for one day overcoming death in their future incarnations. All pain exists, so that from that suffering we create experiences that instruct us how best to continually align with, or adapt to, our divinely constituted bodies into the future. This issue cannot be dealt with without reference to evolution as a whole. We can study this matter best if we test by occult means the relationship of humankind with the realm just below it, with the animal kingdom. We know that, over the course of evolution, humans have always caused animals pain, that they have killed animals. Those who have learned to recognize the importance of karma in human life often experience it as very wrongful that animals who do not reincarnate should suffer, should experience pain, and even as far as higher mammals are concerned, undergo death with a certain level of consciousness. No karmic compensation will take place. Human beings naturally experience karmic rebalancing during Kamaloka for the pain they have inflicted on animals, about which I am not going to talk at the moment. I am talking about compensation for animals. Let us be quite clear about this thought. When observing human evolution, we see how much pain humans have inflicted upon the animal kingdom, how many animals they have killed. What does all this death signify throughout evolution? Occult research shows us that all pain experienced by sentient beings, apart from humans, and every death sows seeds for the future. Just as animals are willed by advancing divine evolution, they are not intended to have incarnations in the same way as humans. But if change is introduced into this wise cosmic plan, if human beings interfere and meddle in animals' evolution, not leaving it in peace as it would evolve without us, what happens then? Occult research tells us that all pain and every death perpetrated by human beings upon animals all return and are restored, not through reincarnation, but because harm and pain has been caused to animals. Such pain and suffering elicits once more or restores their animality. Animals that have been dealt pain are not restored in the same form, but the element in them which feels pain does return. It returns such that the sufferings of animals are rebalanced, each painful experience being replaced with its opposite sensation. This pain, suffering, and death are seeds sown by humankind. They return in that their opposite sensation is adjoined in future. To take a concrete example, when Earth is replaced by Jupiter, animals will no longer appear in their present form, but their pain and suffering will awaken the sentient forces of that pain. These will live in human beings. incorporating themselves as parasitic creatures. The senses and feelings of human beings will create the compensation for that pain. That is the occult truth, which can be spoken of in unvarnished and objective terms, even if this is unpleasant for people of today to hear. Human beings will suffer, and from it animals will derive a certain pleasant sensation, will have a good feeling as compensation for their suffering. This is already beginning to happen, slowly and gradually over the course of our present life on earth, however strange it may seem. Why is it that people are plagued by organisms that are actually neither animal nor plant, but somewhere between the two, entities somewhat related to bacilli, which derive a sense of well-being from human suffering? We have created this destiny in earlier incarnations because suffering and death were inflicted on animals. Because entities experience this throughout the ages, albeit not in the same form, they sense its compensatory rebalancing in the pain which human beings have to undergo. Thus all suffering and pain is absolutely not without consequence. It is the seed from which ensue the results of what has been caused through pain, suffering, and death. No sorrow, pain, nor death can occur without it activating something which later arises, bearing fruit. In view of this, let us review the death on Golgotha, which followed the union of Christ with Jesus of Nazareth. What is first made clear to anyone undergoing an initiation of this kind is that this death on Golgotha was no ordinary death, human or otherwise, to take place on earth. Those who do not yet have faith in a supersensory world cannot conceive of this death on Golgotha at all. Because even from an external perspective, this mystery of Golgotha is fraught with exceptional features, from which much can be learned by human beings. No contemporary description tells of this death, and critics of the Gospels claim that the Gospels do not count as historically authoritative documents. Initiation principles are those applied to what cannot be described in historical terms. What took place on Golgotha can still today be observed by initiates. People who have undergone initiatory processes can see this in the Akasha Chronicle. The writers of the Gospels only wrote what they retrieved from the Akashic record. An event is described, but the original Gospel writers did not think to draw on perceptions of the physical plane. Consciousness was still such that they knew they were dealing with events of the spiritual world, and that the most important aspect was to achieve a relationship with those spiritual worlds. No genuine rapport can be established with these events from the sense world. Initiation makes clear what came to pass. One could say, at the start of our calculated era, Jesus of Nazareth lived, and in the 30th year of his life, a momentous change took place through the assimilation of Christ, and he was crucified 3 years later. And this would constitute an event in the continuing history of humanity. Were one to state it in this way, it would be the opposite of what an initiate would find. It would remain a concern of earthly humanity, however much one tried to spiritualize it. This is not something with which initiation concerns itself. Fundamentally, one can say, and you must not misunderstand me, one can state it radically. Initially, what took place on Golgotha was not an event that concerned humankind, inasmuch as they exist on the physical plane. Initially. Not in the sense that one can relate how a man lived, one Jesus of Nazareth, at the beginning of our calculated era, who in the 30th year of his life experienced a decisive change through the assimilation of Christ, and who was crucified after 3 years. This is not how the initiation truth of Christianity would be framed. One would need to say something along these lines, as the one to be initiated into Christian principles experiences the following. The earth previously underwent a moon condition. During this moon state, luciferic entities remained behind. These luciferic entities developed alongside the forwardly motivated, progressive divine spiritual beings. During Lemurian ages, Lucifer approached humanity and insinuated himself into human terrestrial evolution, causing what was characterized yesterday. In this way, Lucifer became enmeshed amongst the entire evolution of humanity. Had human evolution continued with Lucifer, it would ultimately have resulted in Earth's mission failing to reach its goal. Humanity would have dried up. The human eye would have detached itself, breaking away from divine spiritual evolution. On ancient Moon, a whole array of beings belonging to supersensible worlds had, as it were, discovered that Lucifer had fallen and was opposing them in enmity. Thus the gods had to see how Lucifer had become an enemy of progressive evolution. We can leave aside for now how this affected humankind. Let's view this as a matter for the gods and their adversaries, the luciferic beings, and humanity, as a creation of the gods. That was the situation. Now, there is a certain unique feature of supersensible spiritual worlds. Something is not on hand there that exists on earth. Death in all its manifestations is absent. In spiritual worlds, one is transformed, but one does not die. Metamorphosis, not birth nor death, exists there. Group souls, for instance, existing in spiritual worlds, do not die. Instead, they transform, they morph. Birth and death do not pertain in this realm, where the physical world has never exerted its influence. Only where qualities of the physical world have to some extent transferred to the beings of supra-sensible worlds, is there anything that can be compared with death, such as with nature spirits. But we cannot take that further today. In the actual spiritual realm, there is no birth nor death, just transformation, metamorphosis. In the case of those divine spiritual beings who can be called the creators of humanity, birth and death do not come into consideration. Neither does Lucifer incarnate on earth as a physical human. He works in humans, through humans, using human beings as his vehicle. Thus we are dealing with the gods and with luciferic entities who, as it were, gaze down upon their creations. Had evolution proceeded in this way, had nothing taken place in the world of the gods, then the intentions of those gods for humanity would not have reached fulfillment. Then Lucifer would have thwarted the gods' plan. The gods had to make a sacrifice. That was their situation. They needed to experience something that was infiltrating their spheres in a way that gods are actually incapable of experiencing while remaining within that sphere. They needed to send a being of their ranks to the physical plane in order to experience what gods cannot experience in spiritual worlds. The gods had to send Christ to earth in order to do battle with luciferic principles. Over the course of time, when the time was fulfilled, the gods, who can be collectively called the divine world of the Father, sent Christ downward to learn of humanity's endless pain, an aspect which signifies something quite different for a god than it does for a human being. In this way, did the gods enter into the sphere of earth in order to do battle with luciferic spirits? A god had to undergo death on the cross, the most punishing, abusively ignominious death, as St. Paul in particular emphasizes. For just once in earth evolution, we were permitted to become witnesses, in that we could, as it were, gaze through a window into spiritual worlds at a divine circumstance. Initiation lore of old stipulated that human beings must, under all circumstances, rise to divine spiritual heights in order to participate in the determinants of initiation. In sight of all humanity, a principle of initiation was laid bare in the mystery of Golgotha, an event that was both sense-perceptible at a physical level, to those who had wanted to see, and also supra-sensibly, as an event intrinsically of the gods. That is the essential core, that a god underwent death as a single unique deed, as a balance to Lucifer. And it was granted to humanity to witness this. This is what initiation lore shares as Christian wisdom. It is a source of trust in the truth that to human beings in their human state, a force could flow which can raise them above and beyond the sphere of earth and death, because just once the gods carried out their works on earth, and human beings were allowed to witness them. This is why what flows from the mystery of Golgotha is pan-human, universal in nature, given for all humankind. Just as every pain, every sorrow, every death has its effect, including those inflicted on animals by humans, this death too had its impact. This death was a seed sown by the gods. It was something that remained bound to the earth, a seed that has ever since endured, bound to earth to the extent that each human being can, through trust in and through love of spiritual worlds, find it. They can find it. The initiate knows that this is so. The believing and trusting human being feels that help with their striving comes from spiritual worlds if only they can nurture sufficient faith and trust. That will develop in a quite specific way. There lived those who were contemporaries of Egyptian initiation. As part of their initiation, those initiates instructed their pupils in the whole tragedy of the gods' conflict with Lucifer by symbolically embedding in their mysteries the myth of Osiris and Seth. Yesterday we observed the feelings elicited in Egyptians by this myth of Osiris and Seth. In it there lived the divine spiritual toward which humans were striving. This was named Osiris. Yet on earth human beings could not find a union with Osiris. For this they needed to have gone through the portal of death. Osiris could not live on earth and was immediately cut into pieces. Earth was no place for what was embodied in Osiris. The last cultural epoch before that of Greece looked toward a hereafter, as if toward Christ, toward a Christ-Osiris principle. Then followed the Greek era, which was entirely permeated by the feeling that it is better to be a beggar in the lands of the living than a king in the realm of shadows. This was still the feeling in Greece in the years of the heroes, when the full weight of the discrepancy between the human eye, permeated as it was by Lucifer, and its underlying physical disposition was felt. People felt, as the fourth post-Atlantean cultural epoch ran its course, that they had to grapple with much that could only be experienced on the face of earth. Hence the abnormal and exceptional nature of those times. No other age encompassed as many extraordinary consequences of incarnation as did the fourth post-Atlantean epoch. People had to carry out a great deal here on earth as a result of focusing more on earth than on yonder realm, far more than in the previous cultural age. The Greeks did not greatly value this embodiment in Osiris, focusing more on themselves, filling human incarnations with as much as possible, living life to the full. Hence the remarkable fact that Pythagoras, that great initiator of a particular direction in Greek culture, lived in an earlier incarnation as a Trojan hero, fought on the Trojan side, saying of himself that he had been that Trojan hero, as described by Homer, identifying himself as a foe of the Greeks by later recognizing his own shield. If Pythagoras relates that he was once Euphorbus, anthroposophy teaches us fully to understand his avowal. The Greeks set great store by the significance each physical incarnation bestowed on them, even the greatest among them. However, the fourth post-Atlantean epoch was to lead human beings to feel spiritual worlds in their full significance, because in this time frame occurred the mystery of Golgotha. While Greek culture was valuing the outer world above all else, in a far unknown corner of the world, the mystery of Golgotha was proceeding. In a place where humans were going about their affairs, the gods were staging on an earthly arena their own affairs. If the Egyptians looked upward to death when thinking of Osiris, then those in the fourth post-Atlantean age learned of a contemporary form of religion which contained the impetus for bringing to human beings a sense that in the physical world a divine process was being enacted, which would refute what the Greeks had hitherto believed, that it is better to be a beggar in the land of the living than a king in the realm of the shades. For the Greeks would now learn to recognize the one who, as king among the gods, had descended to earth, and as a beggar, lived out his destiny among human beings. This was the answer to that feeling during the fourth post-Atlantean epoch. It is also the very nexus of feeling from which light can radiate into the future evolution of earth. The Egyptian looked aloft to Osiris, who Christ was for him, so that he could unite with him after death. In the fourth post-Atlantean epoch, the mystery of Golgotha was seen as a contemporary deed that taught humanity how an event had been enacted on earth in which matters of the gods were visible. We live in the fifth post-Atlantean epoch. In our fifth age, since Atlantis, human beings will add the great teaching of karma to other beliefs. They will learn to understand their karma. In our fifth post-Atlantean age, people will experience the third deed which follows on from the deed of Osiris and the deed of the mystery of Golgotha. They will learn to grasp the concept, I was placed on earth through birth. My destiny is on earth. I experience joy and sorrow, and I must understand that what I experience as joy and sadness does not randomly approach me as my lot. It is my karma, my great educator. I look at what existed before my birth, what placed me into this incarnation, because this, my destiny, is important for my future development. Who sent me here? Who will keep me on this earth in my destiny until I have discharged my karma? For this I will thank Christ, that human beings can repeatedly be called to experience their destiny until they have worked off their karma on earth. This is why Jesus of Nazareth could not say to humanity, speaking as Christ, try to take leave of your physical bodies as quickly as possible. Instead, he had to say to people, I will send you to your destiny on this earth until you have dispersed your karmic debts. You need to repay your karma. The nearer we come to the approaching future, the more will people realize that they were united with Christ before birth, that they have experienced being granted his mercy to fulfill their karma through incarnating on earth. It was in this way that the people of the fourth post-Atlantean era looked toward Jesus of Nazareth as to the bearer of the Christ. In this way will the people of our time discover that Christ will manifest in ever more spiritually supra-sensible ways and will increasingly hold sway over the threads of destiny among earthly affairs. They will learn to see in that mighty power the fate which the Greeks could not yet recognize, the power which will lead humankind, in fitting manner, to discharge their destinies over subsequent incarnations. As they experience them in future, people will look up to Christ as if to a judge, as to the Lord of karma, in the sequence of their incarnations. Thus people will relate to their karma such that they are challenged to deepen their souls ever more and more, to the point where they can reflect, I have not been dealt this destiny through an impersonal power. I have been dealt my lot by an element with which I feel related in my inmost being. In my karma itself do I perceive what is related to my being. I like my karma, because it makes me a better and better person. This is how one learns to love one's karma, and it then becomes the incentive whereby one recognizes Christ. Human beings first learn to love their destiny through the mystery of Golgotha, This will proceed ever onward, ever further, and human beings will increasingly learn that Earth could never have reached its goals under Lucifer's influence alone, that human evolution would have become ever more degenerate were it not for Christ. Yet Christianity does not view Christ as a personality, as the founder of an abstract religious system. In our present times, a founder of a religion would establish, in relation to the needs of this time, only non-peace, only strife. Christian initiation does not proceed from a single personality, but from a deed, from a non-personal act of the gods, which was enacted in full view of humanity. This is the enigma of Golgotha. How what took place at the beginning of our calculated time was transmitted, and that from this unique death the seeds were sown, which now arise as humanity's love of their destiny, of their karma. We have observed how the death humans have inflicted upon animals has definite consequences. The death on Golgotha acts as a seed in the human soul, in souls who feel within them their relationship to Christ. It was like this with the mystery of Golgotha. The one died so that we can take that seed and set it into the ground, that it may spring up in the field, and that what has risen from the seed may increase. The death of a god on the cross was made reality in this way. The seed was sown on Golgotha. The ground is the human soul. What springs up is the relationship of human souls to the supersensible Christ, who will never more vanish from earth evolution, and who will appear to human beings in the most diverse ways. Just as people saw him physically at the time of the mystery of Golgotha, so will they in the near future elevate themselves to encounter an etheric image of Christ. They will see Christ as St. Paul saw him. What was veiled in Christian initiation was enshrined in the emblem of the Holy Grail, and was brought into the community which conferred Christian initiation. For those who receive this Christian initiation, what is said here is no mere abstract theory, is not some hypothesis, but a fact of the spiritual world. The ministration or preservation of Christian initiation was entrusted to those who were protectors of the Holy Grail, and later to those who served the community of the Rose Cross. It is, in its very nature, that what is disseminated from Christian initiation is intended to be impersonal. All personal elements were to be excluded, because what is personal has brought only strife and dispute to humanity, and will increasingly cause disharmony in future. For this reason, there is a strict rule among those who, symbolically speaking, serve the Holy Grail, or, speaking realistically, who serve Christian initiation, that none of those in leading roles in the upper echelons of brotherhoods of the Holy Grail or in Rosicrucian communities, that neither they nor those living in their environs are permitted to speak of the secrets that govern their lives until 100 years have passed after their deaths. There is no possibility of obtaining any sort of explanation from a leading person among the first rank until 100 years have elapsed since their death. This has been a strict rule within the community of Rosicrucians since their inception. Nothing is ever gleaned externally about anyone who is a leading figure in the Rosicrucian fraternity until a century after their deaths. By that time, anything shared will long have flowed into humanity and will objectively have augmented the common good. This is why all personal elements are eliminated. It will never be possible to identify any personality as a bearer of Christian mysteries while they are in physical incarnation. This would only become possible 100 years later, and this rule is adhered to by all brothers of the Rose Cross. Nobody from among Rosicrucian brotherhoods would ever confirm a living figure as being a leader of the first rank in relation to what is to flow from Christian initiation into humanity. It could be prophesied in ancient times who would in future come, in the way that prophets were forerunners of their followers, or prophets indicated future founders of religions, as at the time of Jesus of Nazareth, a person then living, such as John the Baptist, could point to one who was his contemporary. But spiritual provisions for humanity had of necessity to change after the mystery of Golgotha. Prophecy can no longer tell of one approaching, nor indeed indicate one already present. Instead, only 100 years after they have gone through the portal of death, can a personality who has borne the secrets of Christian initiation, that spiritual reality gauged by human hearts, be identified. All these matters are not decreed by human will, but because they have to be thus. They have to take place because humanity is on the brink of times when love, peace, and understanding must spread in the process of human evolution. They can only spread if we learn to take matters in a non-personal way, if we learn to represent truthfully everything bequeathed to humanity throughout human evolution. Never again will we as Westerners approach a Buddhist with the aim of persuading them to become a Christian, because we believe that what they have been given as the deepest aspects of their religion will necessarily lead them to Christ. Above all, we will believe in their own truth. We will not hurt the feelings of a Buddhist by claiming as untrue that the founder of their religion, having lived among people as a bodhisattva, as Buddha, no longer needs to incarnate physically. In this way, we foster peace among religious beliefs. In future, a Christian will understand a Buddhist, and a Buddhist will understand a Christian. The Buddhist who understands Christianity will say, "I understand that Christ is related non-personally to his religious principles, and that the fact of the mystery of Golgotha is an impersonal fact, a circumstance of the gods, which a human being is allowed to witness and adopt, and which can connect them with the divine." No perceptive Buddhist will claim to a Christian that Christ can be physically reincarnated. They are more likely to see a breach of true religious principle. No new strife-instigating faith with a personality-based religious leader will be instated in the world. Instead, the initiation principle itself, with its peace, harmony, and promotion of understanding, will enliven mutuality between religions, without pitting the truth of one religion against that of another. In the same way as an Eastern Buddhist would reply to a Westerner who claimed Buddha could reincarnate, "You do not understand the nature of a Buddha." A Buddhist who had grasped Christianity's core and who professed sincere, dignified spiritual knowledge would reply to one claiming Christ's future reincarnation, "You do not understand Christianity if you believe Christ will reincarnate in a physical body." You would then understand Christianity as little as someone understands Buddhism who thinks Buddha could reappear in a physical body. What a Christian who is an anthroposophist will always credit a Buddhist with, if they are an anthroposophist, the Buddhist will also credit the Christian with. And likewise the followers of all the religions in the world. In this way will anthroposophy be a great and empathetic force for unity, one which can synthesize religious faiths across the world. The end of Lecture 8.